Welcome everybody to this session about thematic session about science diplomacy for global challenges, international frames, norms, and ethical principles. As we all know, the science diplomacy actually is becoming a more attractive science, or may I say, approach that is evolving all over the world with the basic, shall I say, principle or the basic belief that science diplomacy can really help us in addressing some of our pressing issues. We always say that how we can strengthen the linkage between the scientists and the diplomats, the decision makers and the knowledge makers. And science diplomacy is definitely one of the major, shall I say, channels that is supposed to fulfill this role. And of course, there are also lots of arguments, whether we are talking science diplomacy, science in diplomacy, diplomacy in science. Regardless of the approach or the definition, the ultimate goal is, I think you would agree, we all would agree, is how we can harness sciences, science technology and innovation, and how can we deploy science in a free way in service of humankind, so it will enable us as human communities and as human societies in addressing our pressing developmental needs. There are lots of approaches, normative instruments made by UNESCO, lots of programs, projects that are going on all over the world. So in this session, we are privileged to have distinguished number of speakers who will be addressing these topics from various points of view. We have with us Elsika Tomalova, Dr. Elsika Tomalova, who will be addressing the issue of water diplomacy, and she will brief us also about a new program, which is S4D4C, which I think you see the banner for. We are also privileged to have with us Dr. Grace Sirju Sharan from COMSET, who will talk to talk about the role of science diplomacy in the case of ethics of climate change. And with us also, we will have Dr. Pauline Ravient, who will address the issue of science diplomacy for global challenges and the role of normative instruments with focus on science will be addressed by my colleague, Ms. Suzanne Vidal, social scientist program from UNESCO, Montevideo. And I will do a small intervention about science diplomacy initiative in the Arab region. So, without further ado, I would like to invite our first speaker, Dr. Elsika Tomalova. Elsika?
Elsika, yes. Thank you.
Yeah, most welcome.
So, good afternoon.
Evening, almost.
Thank you for coming, for joining us in this session. Thank you, Guy, for the introduction and for the preparation of the panel. And I would like also to thank Elkedal for the coordination. I can also see our fellow colleague from a sister project. I will introduce at the beginning the S4D4C project on science diplomacy, but as I can see, I would like to mention that we are fortunate this is not the only Horizon 2020 project on science diplomacy, and I may say that we have somehow coordinated our efforts in advancing this topic not only on the EU but also at the global level. So there has been a cooperation already among practitioners and academics in the field. So first about the S4D4C project. We have 10 participating institutions from two different worlds. The world of diplomacy and national but also international, and the world of science and academia. So I think that we, as a project members, we are already in a laboratory trying to see if we succeed in cooperating together. These 10 participating institutions join their efforts in their academic research objective, but also practical ones. And the coordinating partner of the project is the Center for Social Innovation based in Vienna. We have a double orientation, as I said, in this project, S4D4C. The S4D4C actually stands for Using Science for in Diplomacy for Addressing Global Challenges. And this double orientation is based on the research orientation. We analyze interfaces between the EU, but also in terms of member states' initiative, science policy, and EU and member states' foreign policy. And we also focus on the policy orientation. We produce policy guidance and training for more efficient interfaces, contributing to a better preparation of EU science diplomats. So it means we are in constant interaction with the representatives of different ministries, other stakeholders, and from the EU actors. Let me explain the structure of the project in this three pillar graphics. We have three kinds of cases. The first pillar are foreign policy driven cases linked to diplomacy challenges we face nowadays. In this pillar, we have three cases: infectious diseases, there we specialize on the Zika epidemics and the diplomatic response to that. The water management case, I would rather call it now water diplomacy case, and the cybersecurity case. The second pillar are the science-driven cases, the societal challenges, food, the FET flagships, and open science case. And last but not least, you have these instrument-driven cases on SESAMI, research standards, and integrity and science advice mechanisms. I'm sure my colleagues may also answer more questions about different cases, and I have also some case cards here with me, and you can find more information on the website. But today, I would like to focus on my case. It's not only my case. We've been collaborating with the University of Sheffield Twente and our Charles University team on that issue. I'm really glad to having joined the team. There are many exciting questions related to water diplomacy and science diplomacy, and many research opportunities. You can look into ethical perspective, global actorness, the methods used in water diplomacy. So as a political scientist, I, of course, in a research of this academic gap in the field. How I looked at science diplomacy? Well, in my previous research, I focused on different forms of diplomacy: cultural, public, university diplomacy, but also on these small and very nice diplomatic practices like gastrodiplomacy. And I get a feeling that diplomacy and its instruments tend to be very fragmented. I think that we are mixing these categories, and this is very misleading. We must adjust the taxonomy to find a way how to orientate ourselves in this very heterogeneous network and universe of diplomatic instruments and practices. We have the possibility to look at topics. Of course, cultural diplomacy may be defined as promoting culture abroad to reach foreign audiences by using, let's say, cultural means. You can also use the public category. Public diplomacy, for example, tries to communicate with foreign audiences, not with traditional diplomats. And you may also look at the methods and tools you use. And this is where I think the science diplomacy is interesting. This is mostly the science in diplomacy category for me, but I would like really to have a closer look at this method of everyday work, how they can change diplomatic practices, how they can really change the interaction between different worlds, that interact on the diplomatic level. First, when we started with water diplomacy case, we looked at it from a topical perspective. This is a typical definition. Water diplomacy in the EU context is an area of foreign policy administration in which government officials who deal with water diplomacy issues interact on the national, EU, and global levels. So you have the actors. It is a new field of diplomacy that combines the aspects of science and traditional, and it's defined by the emphasis on water-related topics. So we departed from this water-related topics category on the international level. So no water management only, but water diplomacy, especially access to drinking water, water sanitation, water scarcity, flooding, etc. These initiatives became the subject of transboundary regional and international cooperation. So by definition, in this regard, water diplomacy, water management becomes international, and it's a diplomatic agenda. But if you look at the methods that are used nowadays in water diplomacy, and we were interested more in the EU level because it's a new field for EU diplomacy, you may identify some elements that are innovative in the diplomatic practice. So, of course, we could have started with saying this is like a prolongement of the environmental climate. Now we have water because there's a growing interest in the field. But if you look from the method perspective, these innovative aspects may somehow enrich the debate on science diplomacy in general. So there are, just to simplify, you can find three elements that can be then lift up to the science diplomacy level, let's say. So first, you have the multiple stakeholders involved in the process from the early stage. You could really see some kind of cooperation of different actors, networks, scientists, researchers in the preparation of the Council conclusions on water diplomacy, first in 2013, then second in 2018. So really, from the early stage, the stakeholders were involved in the process. But this is rather a foreign policy agenda setting, the vision setting, the objectives, but it doesn't mean that there's no implication then on the implementation level, because it sets the framework and the way how do we also understand the place and role of different actors in the implementation process. Then there is a multidimensional approach to water diplomacy on the EU level, as also the Council conclusions, but also different projects show. Water is not only an environmental issue, it's a security issue, and that's a very new thing, a socio-economic right issue. So all these combined, it brings a multidimensional perspective. So again, it has an important impact on the methods you use then in the follow-up process. And then, of course, in water diplomacy, you may find aspects of multidisciplinary science-based oriented diplomacy. And I think there is really an emphasis on the cooperation of different disciplines. It also is derived from this multidimensional approach and from this multiple stakeholders landscape. But then you can see that this framework is really implemented in the cooperation of different disciplines in the follow-up. So what does it mean for science diplomacy in general? These three aspects can be defined as the internalization of scientific expertise. And I think this is very important. Of course, external expertise and scientific knowledge can help and fuel administration with relevant knowledge and information. But when you don't invite the experts, the scientists, and the facilitators to participate in the teams from the early preparation phase, I think you still perceive it as an external input, and you don't change the process, the administration methods, the administrative methods. Then second, the cross-cutting understanding across diplomatic agendas. Really stress the fact, as it is done in water diplomacy, then one topic may affect different agendas. And again, as described in the water diplomacy case, it has an impact on methods. And That is, the pluridisciplinarity is nothing new here, and I was really glad to hear it in many sessions. But I really believe this is a prerequisite for better cooperation among diplomatic and scientific actors. So why do I mention cross-functionality and agile management? These are principles, the cross-functionality in teams management and agile management, that are used in business. There are many techniques around, like Scrum methods. And we academics and also state administration is very prudent in using these methods because it sounds too business. But there are many solutions that really have the potential to, let's say, bring new methods that are not less hierarchical, that are more project-based, that bring more cooperation and openness into the everyday work. The problem, as I said, is that there is a lot of hierarchy and the vertical understanding of administrative culture at the ministries, but also in scientific institutions. But I would really suggest to look at the at these methods as those who can help the socialization of the between the two worlds, and also the creation of more open and collaborative teams. So that was the message. Let's focus on methods of everyday work, and let's not like be afraid of management methods that can be also taken from the business environment. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. In fact, I'm using now the stage a little bit. I'll present to you our water diplomacy initiative in the Arab region. So I'll change my seat. Ouch. Well, my colleague just presented something about water diplomacy in Europe, various concepts. I will be presenting to you quickly the Water Security for All initiative, which is an initiative of the Regional Bureau for UNESCO Regional Bureau for Sciences in the Arab states, and it's called Water Security for All: Science Diplomacy for Sustainable Development of Shared Water Resources in the Arab Region and Neighboring Countries. Well, as you all must know, the Arab region is predominantly dry, and for all practical purposes, we are highly interdependent on the waters that are flowing among countries. About two-thirds of waters in the Arab region cross a boundary, an international boundary, and this applies to surface water as well as to underground aquifers. So we are highly dependent on each other. In addition, we are among the driest and water-scarce countries. The most pressing and persisting challenges is water is definitely on top. Seven out of the water poorest countries in the world are in the Arab region. So water is an issue. Water, as I said, is a regionally shared resource with high rates of interleaks. So, not much water, high degree of interlinkages. The result is simple. Regional cooperation is inevitable. Whether we like it or not, we have to cooperate. And there is simply no other way. Coming to water diplomacy. Water diplomacy, in fact, is not something new to the Arab region. It has been there in the ancient times, but let's look at the present times. In the 40s, 50s, 60s, there were lots of water diplomacy initiatives, but what did we achieve? Yes, there were some advancements towards development, towards the developed water sector capacities. We built some capacities. We have better understanding of the physical systems of the surface water, underground water. We have some different levels of cooperation among countries. Few cases of success in data sharing, because data sharing Access to data has always been an issue, but yet much more is needed, and we have definitely an increased sense of cooperation. Everybody believes that cooperation is inevitable. But are we doing it? That's another story. A basic question that we put be simple. After all these 50, 60 years of water diplomacy, are we better off? Are we worse off? Or are we the same? Is the water situation improving? Unfortunately, I think the answer is negative. Reality of benefit sharing remains below what is hoped. There are several central issues that are not solved. State of water continues to decline rather than to improve. Innovative out-of-the-box ideas, socioeconomic developmental solutions are almost missed in the water sector. Joint water governance, as well as management, remains very weak, if any, and transboundary water resources issues are becoming increasingly complex day by day because of the, you know, water is major input in all socioeconomic activities, and it's becoming less highly interdependency rates high, so really the problem is getting worse and worse. So, lesson learned. What do we learn from all this? Science water diplomacy can no longer focus only on sectoral issues. What happened during the many initiatives? Representatives of countries come, sit together, my share of water, your share of water, they fight and nothing happens. And the situation keeps on deteriorating. Socioeconomic, institutional, and political focus must be addressed in the development. We always start with the water. We forgot the social and economic dimensions. We focus on the supply, the demand, etc. And information, we learn that it is a prerequisite for success, and the need for appropriate science. We need the appropriate, and I am saying not any science, science that will help us address our socioeconomic needs, science that will improve the status of water. So I'm using the word appropriate science that contributes to the development of priorities, and definitely we need more awareness among the people. We adopted this, definition of water security, saying that water security refers to the availability of an acceptable quantity and quality of water for health, livelihoods, ecosystems, and production, coupled with an acceptable level of water-related risks to people, environments, and economies. This is the definition that we took from the Arab Water Governance Report, which I had the honor also of working on and coordinating few years ago. So, this is the concept of water security that we adopted. Now we know that the situation is, simply put, bad, and it's deteriorating. What is our objective? Our objective is within the overall framework of achieving the SDGs for all peoples of the Arab region and neighboring countries. The ultimate aim of this science diplomacy developmental initiative is to meaningfully contribute to the establishment of a regional water status that's based on equitable, efficient, and sustainable utilization of water resources. Fine. And we know that this goes along with the established SDGs, Goal 6, the IWRM, transboundary cooperation that call for that, and it really it's highly interlinked with several other SDGs, including SDG 2, 7, 13, and et cetera. So, what we thought of, as said, every time we come, my share, your share, we fight, we go home, nothing happens. So we thought, okay, let's flip the glass. Let's not talk about water. Let's try to find solutions outside of the water box for water issues. So basically, we said adopting mutual, let's talk about mutual benefit programs, adopting mutual socioeconomic, environmental, cultural benefits. Let's start finding a program, a project that involves two or more countries, economic, agriculture, industry, inevitably, whether we like it or not, in a very dry region like ours, you will end up talking about water. So let's find the mutual benefit. Let's promote the other principle is promotion and deployment of science of technology to address. There are lots of technological solutions, but we need to deploy them. We need to disseminate them and ensure that people use them. And the other thing is the effective water governance. We believe that ultimately the water issue is a governance issue. And I'm not talking about management, because governance is at a higher level. It should guide and direct the management. And then management is how to do it in an effective and efficient manner. So promotion of effective governance and to guide and control suggested interventions. And definitely, we need to build trust. Because with no trust, there will be no diplomacy, particularly in a very sensitive issue and in a very highly explosive region like ours, where trust is missing. So, along with that, our initiative is based on these four pillars. The first pillar is, we call it achieving the SDGs for all, the mutual benefits program, as said, to find a project or to identify programs and projects that are of mutual benefit to all. And here we are suggesting to establish the promotion of the concept mutual benefit and to establish a project identification unit for this purpose to bring the countries. We are just brokers as UNESCO, but the idea is to bring the countries together through this. The second one is program, we call it Know Your Neighbor. In many cases, you, even on an individual, we as individuals, we can somehow be enemies with somebody or even hate him or her, not because he or she are bad, because we don't know them. We don't know them well. We are always afraid of what we don't know. This is human nature. So, and again, in many, there were lots of quotes, let's share data, let's do whatever it is. And everybody thinks data is power. No, this is a national security issue. No sharing of data. So again, we flipped the coin. We said, you know something, let's try the soft entry points, the cultural entry points. And let's try really to know each other for the cultural communication. It can be music, it can be story, and then we need to do public awareness campaigns so people in the various countries know each other better, and then we can talk about open access to data. And this will engage also doing some joint research together, joint activities that would really make people and scientists and politicians know each other better. The third pillar, which is effective and efficient deployment of knowledge. As said, we know that there are lots of technological and innovative solutions, but we really need to deploy them. And we need to do research together. And we are encouraging research to do that between two or more countries, of scientists from two or more countries, visiting professors, visiting students, and et cetera. So we are supporting joint research and regional dissemination of science and knowledge, including making prizes, and various activities go under this column as well. Last but not least, matching capabilities as foundation for dialogue. What happens in science diplomacy in many cases, one representative of one country comes very well equipped with all the maps, with all the GISs, with three, four legal advisors with him, etc., or with her, and he's sitting at the same table before him, somebody who's not well informed. So how could be a dialogue between the two if their capacities, I mean, their technical capacities of the negotiators are quite different? So there could be no real dialogue. So we said we have to upgrade the capacities of all involved, and we say matching capabilities as foundation for dialogue, for effective and meaningful dialogue. So, and this involves capacity building programs, joint technical training, and promotion of science decision making interface. And this is one of the linkages that we always stress that should be strengthen the linkage between the scientists, the science makers, and the decision makers, as we call them. And so these are the four pillars. So what are we doing as UNESCO in this? We are just the brokers. We're the facilitators. We are providing the podium. We are not enforcing on any country to do what to do or not what to do, and we are just trying to facilitate the thing. So this is our program in a nutshell, and thank you. To my other hat, changing hats. Now we have our next speaker, Dr. Grace Sergio Charan from COMSET, and she will talk to us about the role of science diplomacy in the case of ethics of climate change. So the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for your suggestions that might assist in enhancing diplomacy to work for water diplomacy, for land resources, for climate change. But I need to add to your suggestions, Mr. Chair, the whole role of values and ethics. And I believe without values and ethics, it's not going to work. So my case is to look at climate change, and particularly the ethics and ethical principles that have been declared to attack climate change. I'll start off with the role of science, because science, I think, is critical. Science, technology, and innovation, we can all agree, is sine qua non for those listed: development, democracy, security, economics, and even human rights. And science has made remarkable developments in all the areas that affect us: energy, health, food, transportation, communication. But we're all aware, and we've been hearing in this meeting, the unintended consequences, that they're very negative aspects, the dual-use technology of science, not only dual-use, but very often the scientists cannot anticipate the negative effects that their research and their technology develop from their knowledge that can have. And we have climate change. We can blame it on the scientists as well. Pollution, plastic pollution, agricultural chemicals pollution, all result of research and scientific knowledge, loss of biodiversity, health problems, cancer, and so on, all exacerbated by science and technology. So the question is, how can we avoid these unintended negative consequences of scientific research and the technology that comes out of it? So in addition to economic considerations, which takes place in diplomacy and policy, and among politicians and decision makers and policy makers, in the past, it was always focused on the economics, how economical this policy is going to be, how much it's going to cost, how are we going to benefit from it. but the father of development ethics, and when we say development, I'm thinking sustainable development, he suggested, Dennis Gooley, that we need to take into account not only economic, but transcendental, that is the cultural, the ethical, artistical, religious, those values, that they have to be part and parcel, part of development. So I would want to look at the role of ethics and scientist diplomacy. And we don't have Dr. Fink here, so I've just listed. Science has always been in diplomacy. Currently, particularly in more recent times, science has been in diplomacy. So, for example, what that means is scientific information is going to be used in policy making, and is happening with the IPCC, for example. So we have a number of independent scientists coming together, a large number, and they are doing scientific research and getting data on climate change, which they are now passing on to the policymakers for use in making decisions on climate change mitigation and adaptation. Also, the Iran nuclear deal was a result of using science and technology in a diplomatic way to come up with with the knowledge of nuclear energy and so on, to come up with a deal and so on. So science have always been, especially in the recent past, in diplomacy. Diplomacy for science, I think, has been even longer. Ever since I became a scientist, we have always had international collaboration among scientists. So diplomacy for science is using diplomatic capacities to advance, and we have lots of organizations funding research like the EU and so on, and international organizations which fund international science projects. So science diplomacy has also worked for science to maintain and facilitate international collaboration among scientists. And the third part of science diplomacy is when we use science to build social capital and trust in order to nourish civil relations. So we have CERN as an example, the Paris Climate Agreement, for example, where science is featured in these organizations to come up with these agreements to build capital and trust. So people have argued that scientists and diplomacy are very similar. Science was involved in peer review, that is in throwing out the publication to the public, well, a particular public, not the wider public, but certainly their peers for review. And diplomacy is involved in public consultation. So I argue it's not quite the same, because I think scientists to engage with the public requires certain skills, which many scientists don't have. And they don't think it's their duty. They think it's their duty. Many scientists are still in the back ages ago, when they just think it's important to do research and put the knowledge out there, and then people can do whatever they want. Now I think the scientist has to engage with the public, and it's a different kind of communication that they need to learn. It's different from the communicating their science for the journals and whatever. Science analyze data, diplomats take questions by citizens, and science coming to open access and sharing, not all of it, but certainly they do some of that. So I'm suggesting for science to become diplomats and to function as in the diplomacy area, they need additional training in communicating with the public, for example, to have some knowledge of what's needed for policy making. And on the other hand, policymakers also need to have some degree of science literacy, I think, in order to accept the scientific information. They need to have some knowledge of science, the objectivity of the research, what they can trust and not trust, and so on. So I think there has to be a two-way kind of further training in order for diplomacy to work with scientists in order to get the information, use the knowledge, evidence-based policy, and so on. The public as well, we talk about public engagement, but the public also needs to be educated in order to contribute. They need an awareness program education about climate change to start off with, if we want them to adopt and adapt to climate change and to recognize that they need to reduce their carbon footprint, each individual, without any knowledge of science. We need to be able to share the scientific knowledge with them, but they need to have we have to build their capacity to participate meaningful in any kind of community engagement, which we are suggesting and hearing throughout. And of course, we need bi- and multilateral decisions. We talk about climate change, but I think we've reached a stage where we have to talk about it as climate emergency. We're seeing that there are irreversible declines in natural environment. Where I live, for example, the coastline is just being eroded away. People have lost their houses. So it's actually happening. This is a small island. The fires that we have raging in specific parts of the world, land degradation, flooding. I mean, there's tons that's happening, and climate change has seemed. I remember when I first joined Commerce in 2014, they just started working on climate change ethics. And I felt this was late. I felt we already know so much about climate change. We are now doing the ethics. It took a year to complete it with adaptation mitigation, and it's on the web website. It's also available very throughout. You can get the climate change report of COMESS, in which the ethical principles have been delineated, but I don't think they're being used as well as they should. But so these are the challenges that climate change also bring. Climate refugees, migration, and urbanization is a big issue. What are we doing with the refugees? And it's increasing urbanization and the problems with urban cities, and certainly worsening social equality. So we know, we are all saying that we need science to achieve sustainable development, and I've just listed some of the SDGs. We've seen them before, so I'll just skip that to say there's a specific SDG on climate action, but actually to deal with climate action, we have to deal with all of those other SDGs, clean energy, land, water, and so on. It can't be just limited, although the interplay is very important. Science diplomacy and open science. So again, I'll go through my slides very quickly because we're short on time. So I want to concentrate on the normative instruments, the ethical principles, which absolutely needed. While we need the scientific information and knowledge, and we need the capacity for diplomacy and so on, the normative instrument, I think, should be a key component in any kind of policy making, decision making, actions that are going to be taken to address the SDGs. And these are some of the listed normative instruments. And I want to start to say that COMESS, which is the World Commission on Committee, the World Commission on the Ethics of Science and Technology, which is a UNESCO committee, they started looking at climate change since 2004, and that took how many years? 13 years to climax with the Declaration of the Ethical Principles in Relation to Climate Change in 2017. So these are all the reports of COMESS, which you can just Google COMESS reports and they will all crop up. And each one of them has the ethical principles and guidelines, and in addition, recommendations for government. Recommendations is what we would like from COMESS, having gone through the reporting, to adopt. So it's all there, but I'm not sure how much is being used. There's also lots of work on UN agencies, on the declaration, principles and agreements, all related to climate change. And also to diplomacy.
Yes.
Okay. So these are some of the ethical principles that we have identified from COMESS. To acknowledge biological diversity and cultural, we need to maintain the interdependence of life on Earth, that we all connected, all organisms with humans, and not only on Earth, when I say Earth, on land and sea as well. Intellectual and moral solidarity, and the other principles. These are some of the challenges for diplomacy, which again, I wouldn't have time to go through. And I will just refer you to the declaration, which is the final document, so normative framework, so to speak, of ethical principles, which has taken into account the work done by COMEST, as well as other instruments, and came up with this climate change declaration. And there's six principles: prevention of harm, precautionary approach, equity and justice, sustainable development, solidarity, scientific, and each one is explained in the document, but not only explained, it also identify applications, how these principles can be applied by member states and countries. So this is all taken from the declaration, so you can just Google this declaration and you'll get all of this information. So with all of this, how much progress have we made in climate change, adaptation and mitigation? Well, we're still having lots of protests, and we have Greta Thunberg, for example. We're having all of the impact on the environment, including loss of biodiversity. And we're continuing to get IPCC reports in various areas that they're working. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We would definitely love to learn more, but time is pressing. Our next speaker is Dr. Pauline Ravient, and she will tell us more about science diplomacy for global challenges. Pauline, the floor is yours.
Thanks. Good afternoon, good evening almost. It's very late. It's not decent so late on a Saturday to be attending a conference. So first, I'm very grateful to my colleague Eliska here, because I'm a partner of the S4D4C project as well, and Eliska presented perfectly the project, so I'm not going to come back on this. I'm going to address some general reflection on global challenges and science diplomacy for global challenges, and also to give you some insights from one of the other 9 case studies of S4D4C project, which is on food security, and that was led by the University of Lille with other institutions in the project participating, Charles University and also TWAS. So to begin with, if we take this notion of science diplomacy and the debates on science diplomacy, it's, well, we all know that these debates discuss the interface between science, science policy, and foreign policy. So if we look at these debates, this discussion between researchers, but mostly among reflexive practitioners of science diplomacy, we can see that we have different categorizations of science diplomacy, but that they tend to overlook the question of ethic and values, which is the one of us here. Well, the classical one of the Royal Society of 2010, but even the more recent now that is becoming extremely trendy by Gluckman and co-authors, which is highlighting different types of interests that can be driving science diplomacy. But here, again, the question of ethics and values is not very much highlighted. So because in this project we're looking at the emergence and development of an EU science diplomacy, we can see that this is a very interesting case to tackle this question of the overlook of ethic and values in science diplomacy. Why? Because there is a strong articulation between EU science diplomacy and the EU global strategy, the way that the EU now frames its external action and its global role. So this EU global strategy, so this EU political strong discourse on its external action, we can see it's meant to explicitly combine the defense of both interests and values. So the question of projecting values, of having a mission, a normative mission, and not only about defending interests, is something that is extremely present in this global strategy. So if we take this EU global strategy seriously, the EU wanting to be and to consolidate as a global actor means to be a power that has the capacity but also the responsibility to act for addressing global challenges. This would be a way to frame the external action of the European Union. So What I want to do next on this basis is to review what we can find about global challenges, both in foreign policy discourse, especially EU foreign policy discourse, and then in EU science policy discourse. So global challenges, what are we talking about if we look at foreign policy discourse, especially in the EU? So first, this notion of global challenges relates to a different understanding of world politics, okay? This profusion, even sometimes this saturation of talking about world politics using the notion of global challenges, This has to be understood with a shift from the understanding of global politics as international in the sense of interstate relations to more global governance understanding of world politics. So with also non-state actors being very important on the scene, social movement, international organization, companies, think tanks, science actors, plenty of actors, okay? Also with the fact that global order is not only produced by interstate relations, okay? That global order is produced by many actors interacting in different transnational networks and arenas. So these global challenges that global governance is dealing with, so they are global in a double sense. So the sense that relate to the world, the planet, global, they're at the global level beyond the national state, and they're transnational. But they also refer to global in the meaning comprehensive, the globality of something. Okay, and this refers to the complexity and the uncertainty of these challenges. So global politics is increasingly about addressing complex transnational challenges in this picture. And so global power of a country or of a region is about the capacity to designate what is a global challenge and also to lead, to coordinate, to connect the response to these challenges. So if we look at the EU global strategy again, we can see that the European Union is stating this very important objective to be a central node of these global networks, and that it's highlighting global governance for the 21st century as one of its external action priorities. Okay, so in this perspective, in this understanding of world politics around global challenges. So a global challenge is a transnational and complex problem that requires multilateral coordination and also a very specific knowledge to be understood and addressed. And so this is for a general definition. And if we want to define specific global challenges, we can see that they relate very much to sustainable development goals. So this is what we can find in foreign policy discourse. So now, if we look at science policy discourse, so here, for a general understanding of this, I'm relating to a very good paper by one of the colleagues within the project, Tim Flink, who is not attending today, unfortunately, because he has been analyzing new forms of discourse in science policy, and this notion of grand challenges and global challenges is one of the new policy discourse, and it's very interesting. So this global challenges discourse in science policy, this is a way to talk about the goals and end of scientific research. And this relates to the social contract between science and society in the 21st century. Okay, so society is expecting from science to contribute to tackling, to addressing this global challenges more and more. And we can find this very explicitly when we look at EU science policy documents. In the last 2 years, in the last two decades, we can see more and more documents framing the objective of EU science policy as addressing global challenges. Okay. I'm switching to food security. So what we've done in this case study for the project is trying to understand food security, EU science diplomacy in the making. Okay? So we've looked at what is going on at the EU level to deploy science diplomacy in the field of food security. And there is indeed a food security diplomacy of the European Union, and this is something that is extremely important in EU-Africa relations. So we wanted to understand more specifically what role did science play in deploying this food security diplomacy. And here the starting puzzle is quite obvious, because we have food security as a key challenge in the EU global strategy, okay? And we also have food security as an important research topic with funding targeted on this in Horizon 2020. So one would expect that you have very designed, well-designed and strategic interfaces between science and diplomacy on food security. So is it the case? So we can see there is a science diplomacy framework of food security, and especially in EU-Africa relations. So we have the institutionalization of different strategic instruments at different levels. There is a joint Africa-EU strategy, and in this strategy there is a very important and dedicated initiative on research and innovation. And the most important topic within this research and innovation initiative in the EU-Africa strategy is on food security. This is like the flagship thing within this program. And if we look at the development of funding instruments at the level of the EU, there is actually a big cross-cutting attention for the mobilization of, internal services here, sorry, not international services. Meaning within the institutions of the European Union, in the development of funding instrument, there was a mobilization for the food security topic in Horizon 2020 that was very important at the European Commission and in different DGs and in coordination with ES. I'm almost done. I'm getting to the problems, so we need to hear about the problems. What is not working so well for food security, EU science diplomacy? So first of all, maybe we should not overstate the consistency of science diplomacy on this case, but also for other cases, meaning there is nothing such as a shared understanding of science diplomacy among the different actors. And also, we can see many frictions between the European Commission and the External Action Service, and also between DG themselves. And last thing, we can observe very contrasted faces in food security science diplomacy in the as a process. Meaning the face of emphasizing global challenges as a priority in EU external action, climate change, food security, this is done and this is well accepted. Then about the step of prioritizing funding on some global challenges for research, here on food security, it works. There is a lot of money in Horizon 2020 on food security. But then, how this scientific knowledge coming from EU-funded research in cooperation with African partner many times, how this knowledge then feedbacks and fuels EU diplomacy, this is still quite uncertain. Okay. So if we conclude on this case, what we learn about EU science diplomacy and global challenges. So the first thing that we learn is that science diplomacy is about principles and discourse. It's also about developing relevant funding instrument, but this is not sufficient. Once you have the principle for science diplomacy to address global challenges, and once you have the funding instruments, then you need to think some organizational formats, some organizational boosters for this interface to work better, to address global challenges. And lastly, on the question of values and ethics, especially on this case, we can say that this is a two-leveled understanding of the question of values and ethics. Okay. So the first level is the level of foreign policy, a sort of macro level of values. Okay. And this has to be with the responsibility and a sense of moral obligation to address global challenges. So there is a kind of important value dimension here. So acting for food security is also in the interest of the European Union for a market reason, for a political reason connected to migration and so on. But there is also very much a sense of moral responsibility. Okay. And then we also have the level of science and the, of the development of food security research. And here we have a series of other ethical commitments and standards. Okay. And then, this is the very last point on the question and of values and ethics on this case, that we tend to think very much science diplomacy and balances within science diplomacy between S and D. Like, what is the balance between science and diplomacy? And here, this is a very good case to see that the question of the balance has to be with the partners involved and in the regions. Okay, because even here, if at some points we can reach a good balance between science and diplomacy, the question is, do we have equal partner, okay, in EU-Africa relationship? In scientific dialogue and in access to research funding and also at the level of the diplomatic dialogue. And I'm done. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pauline, for this. Again, we would have loved to have more time, but unfortunately we don't. Now, we are moving to Ms. Suzanne Vidal, my colleague from UNESCO, who will present to us the role of normative instruments with focus with a focus on science. Susanna.
Good evening. Thank you, Gaid. Thank you, Elke and Anna, for the organization of this meeting. It's a pleasure to be here to try to share some reflections about a UNESCO standard-setting role, especially in the field of bioethics. I will try to be especially in this because the time is not possible. But first of all, I would like just to mention some historical events that for me are very actual, are more actual than ever, and some of the global challenges mentioned before are some way to see that situation that is around the world, inequality, migrations, climate change, and all the other situation, water situation as mentioned before. As you know, UNESCO was created in the immediate post-war period with the aim of promotion, peace and security through education, science and culture. And I think we have been discussing about these issues all these days. And it was establishing its constitution, and we again and again continue reading this. One major objective of UNESCO has been the development of an international normative standard, in particular in relation to scientific development and new technologies. It has a normative mandate in this regard with its two sectors, one a specialized sector in natural science and other in social and human science. And ethics is in social and human sciences. This aspect related to human beings as well as other living beings revealed bioethic concern long before the organization mentions the word bioethic, really before it was mentioned by Van Rensselaer and Potter, that was the first creator of this word. And in 1974, as you know, UNESCO approved the recommendation of the status of scientific researcher that was one of the first international documents for science and scientific researchers. Previously, UNESCO have done other activities in relation to science, but I am not going to mention. And in the next decade, UNESCO focused particularly on the ethical implication of scientific development related to genetics, the Human Genome Project, the life science and reproductive technologies. And it was in 19, 1993 that UNESCO created a global program which called Global Bioethics Program. And in the same decade, it was created some of the international bodies that were mentioned before, the International Bioethics Committee and the World Commission on the Ethics of Science and Knowledge and Technologies, where Grace is a member. And these two bodies are constituted by experts. And this is very important for us. And other intergovernmental bioethics committee that is constituted by representative of the government. And is the place where I think diplomacy is also a very important, take an important place. In 2003, the Director General established a United Nations Interagency Bioethics Committee to avoid the overlapping of the United Nations agencies. What's about this UNESCO standard setting action in bioethics? Well, the bioethics program aims to define and promote a common ethical standard setting framework that states can use in formulating and implementing their own policy in the field of bioethics and ethics of science. From that time, the last years, UNESCO has approved three very important declarations that I am not going to mention, but one related to human genome and human rights in 1997, one related to human genetic data, and the Universal Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights I am going to talk about. In 2017, as Grace mentioned before, was approved the Declaration of Ethical Principles in relation to climate change, and it was a review of the recommendation of 1974, which in name is the recommendation on science and scientific researchers. You can find it in French. It's there in the tables outside. But this is what I wanted to mention especially, which is the normative frames, but especially what is the fund of the Declaration of UNESCO. All of them are based on a consensus about the universality of human rights, and this is an ethical perspective. And all of them are framed in the international human rights system, and this is a legal perspective. Founded on respect of human dignity, fundamental freedom, and equality of all human beings. Why UNESCO? That is a question that has been mentioned several times, at least in the field of bioethics. Why UNESCO is doing that? Well, UNESCO, you know, is an intellectual organization, is an intergovernmental also, and has a strategic position to establish normative frameworks. But placing bioethics and ethics of science in social science sector, UNESCO recognized some important points that I think has been discussed in these days. Ethics need to be rooted in philosophical reflection. It's based on the framework of human rights and function in the context of science, but maintains a critical and independent distance to the sciences. And this was discussed yesterday, and is very important. I want just to establish some points related to the role of the International Declaration and this normative frame function of UNESCO, especially in relation to the Universal Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights. First of all, the roots I already mentioned are the fundamental principle of UNESCO: promote peace, respect for dignity, human rights, and fundamental freedoms. And this is very important because all our activity in standard setting is oriented to these objectives. It's an international human rights system, other international declaration, and the European legal ethical tradition. The scope, one of the main, I think, contribution of the Universal Declaration of Bioethics and Human Rights to the field of bioethics was to establish the scope of the bioethics. In the first point, trying to define bioethics, and they say it said It addressed ethical issues related to medicine, life science, and associated technologies as applied to human beings, taking into account their social, legal, environmental dimension. And it proposed to all around the world to bioethics stay distant from medicine and involve all types of ethical problems related to life sciences. It addresses states in the formulation of their legislation, policies, or other instruments in the field of bioethics, but also provide guidance to decisions of practice of individuals, groups, communities, institutions, and corporations, public and private, proposing a public debate about the ethical problems of life sciences. And related again to the contributions, the declarations offer, first, a normative framework that relates bioethics directly to human rights, and it's an answer to other approach to bioethics, consider human dignity as a founding principle of bioethics, emphasize the importance of the intellectual consideration taking into account contextual realities and diversity in its different expressions, and in this try to link the universal perspective of ethics proposed by human rights with the contextual cultural diversity. Extend the bioethic agenda to include biodiversity and social, environmental, public health, and global issue, and it grants a fundamental role to civil society through its organizations in the dissemination of principle and promoting the public debate. But one of the second offers or contribution is strengthen the ethical bedrock. All human beings without distinction should enjoy the same high ethical standard in research related to medicine and life sciences. And this has been an answer of a huge international discussion about the double ethical standard related to low-income countries and high-income countries, especially in biomedical research. Takes human beings as an integral part of the biosphere who play an important role in the protection of other life forms and emphasize the importance of a special concern for vulnerable groups and country, and finally emphasize equitable access to advance in medicine, science, and technology, and the shared use of knowledge. This, I think, could be an example of which could be the role of an international normative document to the field of one of the fields where we are working. These are the recommendations on science in 2007. You can read the 10 key areas. And finally, two new recommendations are in this moment in discussion in the General Conference, one on ethical principle on artificial intelligence, and other has been approved yesterday by the Social and Human Science Commission and the Declaration on Open Sciences. To finalize, I think that one of the most important challenges is which are the ways to achieve its effective application, especially to the declaration, bioethics declaration. Well, what we are doing is trying to promote public policy with advice to legislative and administrative norms, information, public debate, and an enormous program of education we have, bioethic and ethic of science committee and commission in our activity of strengthening capacity building, and all of this offering a new horizon for the protection of the right of people and the well-being of different type of life in the face of the scientific and technological advance. I think that this is in coherence with the 2030 agenda main ethical objective that is leaving no one behind. Thank you.
Thank you, Susanna. With this, we conclude the presentations. In fact, we had some prepared some questions, but with the time limitation, we still have 15 minutes for some questions from the audience. So let's start here. Do we have a mic? The mic is coming. Here, please. The lady. Thank you.
Thank you.
And for that, for sake of time limitation, please let's limit all our interventions and or specific questions to our distinguished panel panelists, please.
Yes, anyone can answer this. I work more in tech, and so with UNESCO, I've been looking more in the area of artificial intelligence. I listened to all of you. It looks interesting, but I would like to ask Mr. Faris in particular, what are the key elements of the indicator framework that you use to know whether or not you are on track? You have described your approach. You said that you didn't make progress with the previous approach. You've changed the approach. So what are the indicators that you are using to check whether or not you're making progress now?
Thank you. Another intervention, sir?
Okay. Thank you for your speaker, for the speaker and the nice presentations, which is very informative. And I have two short questions because I know that it's really the time press. And my first question is addressed to the representative of the UNESCO, Mr. Gaito, about the water security. So it's really, it's a crucial problem in our area. And you have said that there is these four pillars where we can facilitate the water security in the regions. So I don't know in practical way how the UNESCO could handle this, how they can facilitate it, because we know that we have some problems either in the Nile basins or the aquifer share. So there is, it has been mentioned, but in practical way, how the UNESCO can facilitate this issue. My second question is to Dr. Polina. I think that she has mentioned the water diplomacy, so the water diplomacy for Africa, for food security. And I know that there is one good alternative for projects for the food security, which has been done by the African, with the African Union Commission. And it has issued with the grants for the scientists to handle some, I don't know if we're about it. So what is the future for this program, which is very promising for the region? Thank you.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
I also have two quick questions. So one is to Mrs. Paulina. There are a lot of success of the science diplomacy, but as you said that at one point science diplomacy has nothing to do. It should be up to the policymakers. So if we look at the climate deal, or basically the global powers are going out from the climate deal, it's nothing to do with the science diplomacy, rather the policymakers. Do you, as the policymakers are not going to change very soon in the global global cases or in the places we are standing right now, do you think that it is high time for scientists to go to the general public and communicate them via citizen science what is actually happening? Second question, anyone from the UNESCO can answer that. Basically, the world we know will be destroyed if the policymakers do not take any initiatives soon due to the climate issues or climate emergency. So what role as an international organization you should play on that? You were a facilitator for a lot of issues for a long period of time. Do you think it's a time to change it, rather to go to the drive mode than being facilitation? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other interventions or questions from the audience? Ma'am.
In S4D4C, we also made a little experiment of having a declaration. And as scientists, this was indeed a little bit of an experiment for us. And the UNESCO colleagues are, obviously, this is your bread and butter. How do you see this as an instrument, kind of like for science diplomacy? So we have a Madrid Declaration on Science Diplomacy. What, in your opinion, would be good tools to now further promote this kind of declaration that we have developed? what would you see as the next steps when someone has a declaration on science diplomacy? And obviously we're inviting everyone to sign this declaration if you are interested in.
Thank you very much. Any other intervention before we give the floor back to the panelists, including myself, it seems? Ma'am?
Hi, thank you for the presentations. I'm the senior co-chair of iCorsa, so my question is for the S4D4C project, so anyone from UNESCO. I was just wondering if there will be any science diplomacy workshops. I saw that there was two, but November and October. And I also wanted to ask, at what stage is the project? Is it completed? Is it ongoing? Is there still floor for partnership in science diplomacy? Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Here, please. And then the lady in the back.
Okay, thank you for the presentation. I'm Hazel from Sudan, and I still see that science diplomacy concept in developing countries is not something popular, even for us as scientists. I have been trained last August in Tiwaz and when in science diplomacy, trained a course in science diplomacy. And frankly saying that when I went there, I was really confused about the concept of science diplomacy. So to bring issues like food security and water, like for my country is now in conflict, this water between Ethiopia, Egypt, and this one. We need to bring at the level also of scientists and the diplomats. So how UNESCO can play a role on this.
I'm Bolanle Ojoko from Nigeria. My question is has some relationship with the one the last speaker asked. One of the speakers, when she was presenting, was trying to distinguish between science and diplomacy. Telling us that the differences between the two, but we still call it science diplomacy. Is science outrightly different from diplomacy, or where does the margin between the two concepts lie? That's my question.
Thank you very much. So we go back to our panelists, and we'll give the chance for all of us, I think, to answer some one or more of the questions. So should we start by your good self, Susanna? But just press the button here. And please, yes, because of time limitations, 1 minute, 2 minutes.
Yeah, no, it's very brief. Just in relation to, because something that somebody mentioned about which is the role of UNESCO in produce and promote declarations, because a lot of time people said, one more declaration is just papers and lines and articles. But I want to, at least in ethics, that is where I worked, I would like to highlight the process that arrived to a declaration. And I think that this process, in some sense, has an enormous importance to arrive to the application of the ethical principle. First of all, the process of establishing a declaration begins with an enormous round of consultations. And this reflection about workshops and consultation with member states, with stakeholders, with governments, and also with civil society and non-governmental organizations. But after have a manuscript, there are a lot of discussion. And finally, when this manuscript or draft arrived to the commissions and finally to the General Conference, a huge discussion is also there among member states. But after that, when a document is approved, UNESCO established a strategy for its application. And its application means how we are going to try to transform these ethical principles in a social transformation, means in policies that are going to transform our society and really put in practice these principles. This is one activity very important with advice government in policy making, education, and the third one is capacity building through different instruments that in each case is different. Just this.
Thank you, Susanna. Paulina, would you like to?
Thank you very much for the questions and comments. So first question about initiatives of the African Union. So I'm sorry if we overlooked anything that is done by the African Union in the case study. So the framing of the case study was really exploring whether the European Union is aligned between its objective in foreign policy addressing global challenges, among which food security and the development of instrument of science diplomacy. So we've been looking especially at funding instruments because we know this is extremely important. And in terms of funding instrument for food security in Africa, so you have two streams. You have the mainstream, which is a research topic within Horizon 2020, and then you have a budget which is transferred to the African Union, which is a program for grants for African scientists. But the money is transferred to the African Union, and the African Union is completely independent in the way then to manage this grant program. Okay, so this is what I can say, what is directly and institutionally connected to the research and innovation strategic partnership within this joint strategy. And for other programs of the African Union that are not directly connected to the European Union, this is not within our window of looking at this. The other question was about the lack of hope about policymakers changing their perspective and turning to citizen science. So I'm not nor pessimistic nor cynical. So I'm much more optimistic actually than the question was. I mean, the European Union is funding project of science diplomacy, okay? Several ones, and our project is explicitly the S4D4C project about interfaces, frictions, existing problem for science to inform a better external European Union policy and so on. So we are asked to provide some recommendation, which is very challenging for a scientist to be asked to provide some policy recommendations. So we are going to see in the future, but I think that there is going to be a move in the coming years, and that also with the evolution of the training of the diplomats and everything, things can move. So this has to be articulated to citizen science, of course, but I'm not so desperate about policymakers and their openness to more science to fuel diplomacy.
Thank you very much. And Dr. Grace?
The issue of water security and food security and land security, or land definition, just to say that the normative instruments developed by UNESCO, UNES, identifies clearly the principles that need to be taken into account when you're looking through policies and making decisions in these critical areas. So, for example, between Egypt and Sudan, their transboundary water issues, it's clearly stated how action should be taken, what governments should do, for example, and similarly, food security. let them know. So from the start of the research project, they must start with looking at community engagement, and all those principles are articulated in the local framework. So I think we just need to take it from there.
Thank you very much. Dr. Ilska?
Yeah, thank you. Just a practical question on the project. So S4D4C, it's... So S4D4C is an ongoing project. We started in 2018. It will finish next year with the final conference in November 2020. We are now in the finalizing phase of the cases and of the government's network. And there will be now a special volume also on science diplomacy at Palgrave Communications. But concerning the workshops, the two you mentioned, the deadline for these workshops is closed down. The one in Trieste, the one in Vienna will take place next week. So I don't know if Elke Dahl would like to add something to the topic. So maybe, no.
There will be online modules that we're also preparing.
Voilà. So thank you for the question.
Thank you very much. Let me try to also very quickly answer your questions. First of all, about the water diplomacy initiative that I presented. When I said that, when I looked at the previous failures, were throughout the last 50, 60 years. Definitely, we are trying to establish KPIs. We did establish KPIs for us, for ourselves. We did thus far. We went. Understanding the political dimension and that we need the blessings of the governments, we already secured, shall I say, the approval, initial approval, and of the Arab Water Ministerial Council for that. We got a green light for that. Now we are in the process of mobilizing some resources. The basic KPI in that is simple. If we manage to get one or two mutual benefit projects on the ground, we're now in the mobilization period. We call it mobilization through action. This is our target for the next year, provided that we get the funding. Now, how much can we expand on that? It will depend on the member states that are engaged and how much they will be interacting with it. Because ultimately, as said, our role as UNESCO, we are facilitators, we are brokers. Ultimately, it's up to the engaged member states, and as I said, we have already secured, at least for the Arab region, some other countries have expressed interest to be part of this program, so we are advancing, but we are advancing slowly but surely in that. I will just be very quick about how, the questions raised about how UNESCO deals with the various global issues, declarations. Well, again, we are brokers. We are member states. We ultimately implement what the governments, what our member states tell us, in addition to what my colleague just said. So our role, we are brokers, facilitators, we provide capacity building, but we cannot impose. And I always tell myself and tell my colleagues in my office, I always say, we do not make the developmental goals or policies in any country. We simply put, it's the job of the countries, starting from the president, the king, up to the low, whatever apparatus they have. It's their job, the ministers, grades and levels. Our job is to serve them. We can advise. We can have an opinion. We can have a stand, but we don't impose. Definitely, we cannot and we should not, and we cannot to start with. So this is our role. We are the podium. We provide the podium for the interaction. We facilitate this interaction. We try to trigger this dialogue, the societal dialogue at the national, international, regional levels, similar to this, and this is where our role. And we definitely try to build the capacities and provide elements of success to that, to the best of our ability. And this applies to the declarations. What are the declarations? Declarations, what we member states sat together and they agreed to that. We can help them implement it, but this is what you agreed to. So it's ultimately, and that's what I always say, it's ultimately the responsibility of each one of us when we go back to our countries is to remind our decision makers of what they signed to. And definitely we at UNESCO are always there to facilitate and provide all possible support to that. With this, I would like to conclude this very interesting session. I would like to thank all the panelists that have enriched our discussion for their contributions and sharing their valuable experiences. I would like to thank the audience who have been continued to be active despite the late hour. So thank you all, and good luck.